This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hey, Katie.
And our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
Richard Lawson is off on vacation this week, hopefully not watching movies or thinking about them and just floating in a pool somewhere. He'll be back eventually. But this week we have a lot to talk about and a great show. We have an interview that Mike did with Ben Stiller, who directed the Showtime series Escape at Dannemora and reunited with Patricia Arquette and kind of made this huge splash in prestige TV. So Mike will talk a little bit more about that interview later. And then we have the next installment of the Little Gold Men book club. Joanna and I will be talking about How to Build a Girl, the novel by Caitlin Moran. But first, just very brief festival season news. Toronto announced another wave of films that are going to be in their galas and special presentations, which is typically where you see most of the Oscar buzzy titles. The one like sentimental favorite that I saw in there was The Aeronauts, aka the Eddie Redmayne, Felicity Jones hot air balloon movie. And then Joanna, I think we're both excited to see Lucy the Sky on there. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a feature film debut, I believe, from Noah Hawley, who did the TV series Fargo, as well as Legion. Stars Natalie Portman, John Hamm, Dan Stevens, and it's based on the true story, loosely based, I think, on the true story of the female astronaut who got romantically entangled and did a very infamous, like, sort of cross-country drive about it. But if you watch the trailer for the film, like, this is not any kind of biopic or anything like that. It's very dreamy, very surreal, which is very Noah Hawley. So I'm really excited to see what he does in that space.
It's not a sequel to Yesterday. It's not another.
not as far as I know.
They find Beatles songs in space.
Natalie Portman is the only one who remembers the Beatles.
Yeah.
It's intriguing to see this coming into Toronto a year after Vox Lux, which kind of popped up at the last minute and was pretty polarizing. Mike, I can't remember if you saw it there, but people tended to either really love it or really hate it. And I wonder if this might do a similar thing with another Natalie Portman performance.
I did not see it there, but yes, it was kind of up or down. And then maybe this is Natalie's thing. This is her strategy. She's like, I like to just drop a last minute movie on the Toronto people. I don't know why you would do that, but
I mean. They just announced the release date of this film, and my sense from talking to Noah about like his work on Legion is he had just a lot of balls in the air. You know, he's also writing Fargo, finishing Legion, and editing this all at the same time. So I think the question was like, will this even be done in time for Toronto? And they made it. Looks like they made it.
Congratulations!
So. Plus, it's Fox Searchlight, so I don't know. What's going on with Fox Searchlight this season? That's a big question we want to keep our eye on, right?
Yeah. And speaking of actresses who inspire intense feelings and make interesting choices, the Jean Seberg biopic starring Kristen Stewart called Seberg is going to be at Toronto. It's going to be at Venice as well, so Richard will get to see it first. But Kristen Stewart, our most recent cover star, she's also got Charlie's Angels out this fall. It's going to be a really interesting season for Kristen Stewart, so I'm excited to get a chance to see that.
The Kristen Stewart magazine cover is just arriving in the mail for our subscribers. And I've had a bunch of them send me photos of like the copy in their house. And they don't usually do that. And I'm like, all right, Kristen has arrived in people's houses.
It's a really good cover. Not to pat ourselves, our colleagues on the back, but this is a good one. Yeah, mine just came too. It's nice.
I enjoyed someone on Twitter who pointed out that she is dressed, and I think this is a compliment, but exactly the way that Roman Polanski is in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, like the velvet jacket and the like frilly collar. And she looks so stylish, and it's an interesting point about how fashion trends come and go, and maybe we'll all be dressing like we're in the late 60s before too long. So Joanna, before we start the book club segment, we have a breaking news. The Little Women trailer is finally here. I don't know. I just kind of sat and watched with a dumb grin on my face. Do you have critical thoughts on the Little Women trailer?
Yeah, I watched it that way once and then again with notes. Well, the first thing that struck me was like how much we talked about this last week at the book club, like how adult Amy is so underdeveloped in so many filmic adaptations, and mm-hmm. how much in this trailer alone we see of adult Amy as like not just like, you know, better than she was as a kid, but like a woman with ambition who wants to be an artist and all of her like artistic endeavors, and also how they seem to be setting up, you know, you see her with this other suitor that she has in Europe who's in the book. And so setting up Lori as like maybe not like the rich boy, she has other rich boy choices. So it's not like, oh, she just married the rich boy. It's like she married the person that she like actually loved, you know, like setting up that choice to make it so much more like an active decision for Amy. Do you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, it's very Amy and Joe heavy, who are kind of the most active characters in the book, I think. Like Meg mm-hmm. is in there as kind of a, you know, you see Emma Watson, she's a big star, and then you really barely see Beth, which seems kind of smart to me for the tone of the trailer. Like it's very lively. You've got a lot of people like running around and hair flying everywhere. It's like, it's very much saying like, this is a period movie, but it's not going to be like a bunch of stuffy like scenes of people sitting in rooms, which I think is important for people who might not automatically be sold.
Yeah, that goofy shot of them sort of like jumping up and down, Lori and Joe jumping sort of up and down at the end of their dance outside the ball.
Yeah.
When they first meet is like borderline anachronistic, but like not quite there. And it's just very cute.
But you do get a lot from the two of them being so kind of like bucking the trends of the time. Like I think you can get away with a lot of Joe and Lori being like, oh, to hell with this like fancy dance. We'll go dance in a closet together, which is what they do in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And like something that I love about this, like, first of all, like, count how many times a woman in the trailer says, I want, you know what I mean? It's like so much about ambition. It's just so much about like what Joe wants and needs, what Amy wants and needs. She, like, there are two, I think, I want moments for Amy of like, I think she says, yeah, I want to be great or nothing, you know? And it's all this sort of stuff. But there's also something else we talked about in the book club is how the book itself has so much love and respect for all four sisters, all different kinds of femininity, right? And that's in this trailer too, immediately, where you've got the sequence of, you know, Joe doesn't want Meg to get married, and Meg is like, just because what I want is different from yours doesn't make it less, you know?
Yeah.
And so this reframing of like Meg, who, you know, people write off as this like domestic bore, and she's just like, you know, I want to be married. This is what I want.
Oh, and man,
like,
and her wedding looks so gorgeous. Like that one shot of her like outside with like wild hair and like a flower crown. Like, again, I have no idea how period appropriate that is, but I love it.
We also get a shot of like a Marmee and Joe talk, which is some of my favorite stuff in the books, where Marmee is just talking to Joe. We talked about like specifically the talk she has about the temper. And I think she says something about like some wills are too strong to bend or something like that, you know? So like the mothering of Marmee and the one-on-one and the intimacy of it. And this is obviously something that Greta Gerwig, I mean, it's a more troubled mother-daughter relationship in Lady Bird, but this is something that Greta Gerwig is obviously like very intensely interested in, which is the passing of like wisdom from mother to daughter and stuff like that.
Yeah. So. Can we talk about Tracy Letts popping up as like an editor character who I know that like she has an editor, but I don't remember ever like this person ever having lines, but it's such this great meta moment in the beginning and the end of the trailer where he's asking her to write about like who they all get married to. And then at the end, she kind of rolls her eyes at it. It's kind of like Burn After Reading, where you get to the end and J.K. Simmons is like, what did we learn from this? But I don't know. I can see it working within the tone of this as the trailer depicts it.
Yeah, I you're right. This is a very meta moment, like something we talked about also last week. Basically, like, listen to our discussion. It was great. but something we talked about also last week is how Joe March is or how Louisa May Alcott was sort of bullied into giving Joe a husband.
Yeah.
At the end of Little Women, how she like kind of wanted Joe to not get married and how her editor sort of pushed her to that. So like the editor is doing the same thing for Joe, where he's like, okay, make sure she's married. Like you can make Joe spirited and willful or whatever, but make sure she's married in the end.
Yeah. It does make you wonder what they're going to, I mean, we see there's casting for Professor Bear in the cast, but it makes me wonder if they're going to fiddle with that a little bit, or at least like have her keep her writing career even after she gets married.
Yeah, that would be great. Have a school for boys and a writing career. Lean in, Joe. Have it all. the other meta moment, I think, is the movie calls Meg out as an actress. And like Meg, I think in the book, is the like the best performer of the group.
Mm-hmm.
Louisa May Alcott's real life sister she based Meg on actually was an actress. So like this idea of giving the girls, all of them, sort of equal artistic pursuits, painting, acting, writing, for Beth it's music, you know, is a way that I think Greta Gerwig has found to just really give them all some kind of artistic expression for who they are, which is just fabulous. I'm so excited.
I know.
It's gonna be so good.
I mean, Timothée Chalamet as Laurie is, I think, everything that we talked about him being.
Yeah.
And just seeing him, like he and Saoirse have such great chemistry, which I think even Greta Gerwig talked about in the feature we did in the movie, and just seeing them together as Joe and Laurie. Like they have the big Joe and Laurie proposal scene in the trailer, which is, I mean, I guess you can't really spoil Little Women, but that's such a pivotal scene, and it's interesting that they wanted to show that off so early.
Yeah, I mean, that's a, I feel like that's such a smart move where it's like, okay, there's going to be things in this movie you don't recognize as Little Women. Like, look how much Amy March there is, which mm-hmm. like maybe people who only know the 94 film version are not expecting that. Who is this editor character? Like, what is this stuff that, you know, we're unused to seeing? But don't worry, there's like stuff you very much recognize, like the proposal scene with the same language from the books as in the movies. Like, it's here too. Like, this is the Little Woman you recognize, but also we have new things to say. I'm just so, I mean, of course I trusted Greta Gerwig to do this, but like, I'm so impressed. Just the Amy stuff in this trailer alone makes me so impressed. It makes me feel like she better understood what Louisa May Alcott was trying to do in terms of like, show love for many different kinds of women.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it is easy to do a good Joe and it's harder to do a good Amy or even a good Beth. And we'll see sort of, as you say, Beth is sort of just in the background a bit in here, but it's so much harder to do a good Amy. And I think that that's the, like Greta Gerwig's like challenge fucking accepted, you know? So I'm really excited.
Yeah. Oh my God. Little Women, bring it now. We have so many like fall movies to see before we finally see Little Women at Christmas, but I'm ready.
I'm impatient. Someone show me this movie. I need to see it immediately.
Well, we'd like to welcome you to the next installment of our Little Gold Men book club. Joanna, I think I speak for both of us when I say this has been an incredibly fun way to spend August, and I've loved how many people responded to us about Little Women already.
I know. I've been amazed that people, it's just fills my heart with joy how many people wanted to listen to us talk about books and are reading themselves this summer. So, this is like hot book girl summer over here at Little Gold Men.
Well, I like the idea that we call it Girl Summer because we have another book about a young woman. It's called How to Build a Girl. It's by Caitlin Moran, who is a columnist in the UK. She kind of became famous for, you know, writing for newspapers. And then she wrote this book called How to Be a Woman and then followed it up with this novel. It was her first novel that she published. It's a coming-of-age story. I definitely didn't think when I decided to do this after Little Women about the fact that it's about a teenage girl named Jo who wants to be a writer. I did not make that connection at all. And it contains a few references to Little Women, like the main character, Johanna Morgan, is a voracious reader, and she talks about like wanting to make money to support her family the way that Jo March does. I don't know. I'm talking a lot. Joanna, do you want to do the brief rundown of what this book's about? I feel like fewer people will have read this than Little Women.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's quasi autobiographical, right? It's based on Caitlin Moran's like own upbringing.
Okay, is it Caitlin? Is that a Britishism that I don't know?
I think it might be, but okay. It might be Caitlin Moran. I don't know. It's I also am worried I'm pronouncing it a little Irish. Anyway, she's not Irish. She's from the Midlands, Wolverhampton, and it's about her family, which grew up very impoverished and on welfare, and her father is this like frustrated musician, and she has a talent for writing, and she basically sort of writes her way out, Hamilton style, and gets a gig as a rock critic at the tender age of, I think it's 17. She's very young.
Yeah.
And she sort of lives this like wild rock and roll, rock critic lifestyle for a bit. And then comes to a realization about the extreme she was going to and trying to escape her life and how to maybe try to live her life a bit more comfortably in herself while still having these great adventures. There's a few figures that are really compelling in the book that I'm excited to see on the screen. One is her brother, Chrissy, who's sort of this great, you know, support for her, the Meg to her Joe March, I guess. And then there's this great figure called John Kite, who is a, you know, a rock and roller who she has this connection with, who will be played by Alfie Allen of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
We should also mention that Beanie Feldstein will be playing the character of Johanna Morgan. And this book engages in Catelyn Moran's own upbringing as someone who was like, felt overweight and awkward. And, you know, it's done, as you say here in our notes, Katie, it's done like delicately, but unflinchingly. It's just sort of like, this is a true depiction of someone who grew up feeling like she didn't fit in for a number of reasons. One of which is like how she looked. And the other is this question of poverty. And it's not like whimsical poverty. It's like, we don't know how we're going to eat kind of poverty, you know? And I feel like books like that, like, books by like Frank McCourt, like Angel's Ashes, or Dorothy Allison books like Bastard of Carolina, like these depictions of, you know, the kind of poverty you don't often see or you don't often understand the realities of, it adds a really interesting component to this. And because it's autobiographical, it just feels like so completely authentic. And you know, the author has talked herself about how infrequently she's seen stories about the way in which she grew up, this level of poverty, and how she feels like lucky and responsible to be in a position where she can shine a light on that for people. So,
yeah, I mean, we should mention that this movie is going to be at the Toronto Film Festival. It's directed by a director whose name I'm going to butcher is Koki Gedroych.
Gedroych.
Oh,
and the only reason I know that is because her younger sister, Mel, is one of the co-hosts on The Great British Bake Off. So,
wow. God, I love
Mel Gedroych's older sister, who actually has like a crazy lot like that. Like Koki is like her cute nickname, but she's like a lady. She's like she's got a whole long title. It's a whole thing. Anyway.
Wow. So, yeah. And yeah. She's done directing for television, including Harlots and Penny Dreadful.
She's got two features that she did, but like the last one was in, I think, the late 90s. Yeah, she did Stella Does Tricks in 1996 and Women Talking Dirty in 1999. Women Talking Dirty is Helena Bonham Carter and Gina McKee. I really like that film. And then she just like didn't do films for two decades. And here she is back in the saddle.
And it's unclear who might distribute this film in the U.S. and when we might see it. So it's very possible to be one of those movies that premieres at Toronto and then doesn't open till next year. It's like it may or may not be an automatic awardsy thing, but then we would have said that about Lady Bird. So you never write anything off. And anyway, just so people know, I don't know when you'll be able to see it, unlike Little Women, which has a set release date.
Can I read you Koki Gedroych's full name?
Yes.
It's Mary Rose Helen Gedroych, comma, Lady Bower hyphen Smith, and Smith is with a Y. So,
wow.
It's a beautiful situation.
I want to read some interviews with her and Caitlin Moran just talking about British class and like when you come with a name like that and then make a movie about someone from Wolverhampton, like what you have to learn.
Yeah, exactly. So I loved this book. Like
when did you read it?
So, okay, here's the full story. I actually read part of it when it first came out, which was in 2014, because I had to interview Catelyn Moran for VanityFair.com.
Oh.
And I didn't have time to read the whole thing, so I read part of it, and I really liked it, but then I just never picked up and finished it. So I was really glad that we, like, had this excuse to finish it. But I have, like, reading it, I realized some personal things. Am I allowed to share personal things in book club, Katie?
I think that's what books are all about.
Excellent. I realized that when I was preparing for this interview that I did, I watched a bunch of like videos, which is something that I do, you know, because there's so many interviews that exist out there with these fine, smart folks, and you don't want to ask them the same question they've been asked a million times. And so I often just watch these interviews to sort of make sure that I'm not retreading territory. Anyway, I watched a bunch of interviews with her where she talked about, because she is, you know, if you've never seen her, I mean, she's incredible. She's so funny. She's so sharp. She's just one of the greatest people. And but she has a very distinctive look. She back combs her hair, teases it really high. She's always got this like sort of defiant little like white streak in her hair, or occasionally has that. She's got this great like winged eyeliner. She just has this like very distinct look, and she wears like tights and Doc Martens, this whole thing. And I just know, like, I'm realizing now, remembering those videos, remember reading this book when I first got hired at Vanity Fair in 2014, that I felt like as a writer, I needed to have like a look.
Oh,
like,
man.
To distinguish myself. And that is definitely 1,000% why I started dyeing my hair purple, why I got glasses that had like thicker rims, like all these sort of things. I was like, I modeled myself on her.
This is very Dolly Wilde of you. That's what the book's about.
It's so meta. It's exactly what the book is about. And I was just like, and like, you know, I did that initially, and then I just sort of, it's not like pretend, it's not an act or whatever. It's just something like a little extra thing to do to, you know, give you that extra bit of like fake it till you make it, which is a big like theme of the book, fake it till you make it sort of feeling. Because I felt like, I don't know how you felt when you got hired at Vanity Fair. When I got hired at Vanity Fair, I was like, this is a huge mistake, and I will eventually realize. Yeah, exactly. I was like counting down, you know, the minutes until I got fired, and you know, 5 years later, I'm still here. So like,
yeah,
but that was a coping mechanism that I used. And hearing her both talk about it in interviews, and then, you know, because she went to an extreme when she was a kid, because she's a kid. But she settled back into something that did feel comfortably her. But if you ever look up photos of her, it's so funny. This is something I noticed recently too. She's like a lovely woman, but she's often just pulling like an antic face in a photo. And it feels like this is just also part of her like coping mechanism with the spotlight. Of she's just sort of like, I'm wild and I'm eccentric and like, you know, this is who I am. And there's so much of that truth in the book itself. Once again, this is not nonfiction, this is fiction, but it's so obviously like autobiographical that it's really sweet to read about.
Yeah, the sense I get is that she kind of like, I mean, there's a lot of like actions that happen in the book that like there's a very, you know, convenient moment where she learns to like care about music, and like that's, you know, it's probably didn't happen quite like that in real life. And I think her parents are maybe made a little bit more dramatic characters than they were in real life. But yeah, right. I mean, there's just so many things that, you know, the way she writes about like deciding who she wants to be and how she feels about the way she looks and how she feels about like the bands that she's listening to and what music makes her feel, like that it feels so very personal. And it's one of the questions I have about watching a movie version of this is her voice is so essential to what makes this book work. Like, as you said, she's so funny. Like, she has such a way of describing things. And I think films can capture a lot of things about these teenage emotions and coming of age. But I wonder what it might lose from not having her voice guiding it.
We should say she co-wrote the script, so like there's at least that much of her voice.
Yeah,
but the thing that I'm actually worried about is accent, because like I don't know if Beanie Feldstein, I'm sure she can do anything, but like all through this book I was like, why didn't they cast a British girl for this, you know?
I mean, it is the year of Beanie, so like it seems anyone who doubts her seems like they will be like smited in her wake. So, but I know what you mean. Like, I mean, although who am I? Like, if she has a bad working class British accent, I'm not gonna know.
I'll know.
You're a better accent than I am.
I mean, I'll just know if it's inconsistent. So, like the best model that I could think of for this, because it's a similar ish. I don't know, situation is Renee Zellweger playing Bridget Jones. Like, Bridget Jones is such like an iconically British, and it's also in its own like sort of slightly softer, pinker way, like such a feminist tale of self-acceptance, you know. So and Helen Fielding, you know, like I think she's friends with Callum Moran, like they're, you know, the woman who wrote Bridget Jones' Diary. So like it works. I mean, Renee works in that role. She's great. So it's, yeah, I'm hoping it works. I'm hoping it's incredible. That's all I want for this. Because there is a lot, there are a lot of incidences in the book that are very cinematic, and I could see this becoming just like a classic comedy. I would love that, for this.
Yeah.
And something that the author talks about a lot is this idea of, in her interview, she talks about the idea of weaponizing humor as a way to get some messages across. She's like such a passionate feminist, right? And so she cares so much about teaching young, you know, she's a mother of two girls. She cares so much about teaching young women how to accept themselves, how to love themselves, how to fight for their space in the world. And she has this great, I was reading some interviews with her. She has this great quote about why she uses humor for that. She says, everyone's buttocks immediately unclench. People actually listen to what you're saying. Plus the revolution becomes fun again. you know, so that like that importance of humor in telling this story and how genuinely laugh out loud funny. Like I was sitting in my kitchen and I don't know if you've ever laughed out loud in a book. You didn't realize that you're doing it until someone else is in the room and they're like, what are you reading? So that was my experience.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then, grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
What are some of those funny parts of the book or like scenes that you really feel strongly about seeing in the movie version?
I don't know that I feel strongly one way or another, but I will say that like there is a sequence where she's basically stuck in a bathtub for an entire night and copes with that, and that's a fairly charming interlude. So
Yeah. I feel like it's so maybe talk about getting to the Alfie Allen, but I feel like the relationships that she has with this musician named John Kite, who is a super complicated figure of like this guy in his early 20s who is like not having a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl, but is like definitely romancing her in this way and like staying up all night and drinking way too much. So I'm curious about how those edges might get softened or maybe not. But I'd like the intensity of their kind of platonic romance, like the way that they like wander around all night in these cities and kind of like break into a zoo and like go sit by the water, like that stuff, it feels so cinematic. And it feels like it kind of jumps right off the page and is ready to go into a beautiful montage.
It's funny because I was trying to think of like how to successfully execute on screen these sequences of like someone you meet that you can talk to all night. And I'm like, okay, what does the, you know, can they capture a, you know, before sunrise, before sunset sort of feeling of like the walk and talk where you really understand the connection between two people. That's I think a challenge to capture. And I just found myself thinking like, okay, if I were a filmmaker, what films would I look at to try to reference to make sure I got this exactly right? Cause it is an incredibly important part of the book. And it's hard. It's hard to like the meeting of the minds, you know what I mean? A hard thing to really make happen on screen. So
how are we feeling about Alfie Allen as romantic hero? I mean, I I know, I feel like you are 100% here for it and could not be more here for it.
I mean, you're the one who messaged me in the first place. But I mean, what's interesting is John Kite, who's this very interesting figure. I was reading some interview. I Googled, like, who is he based on? Like, is he based on, you know, an actual rocker that she met in her journalism days? And much like Louisa May Alcott talking about who Laurie is based on, she says he's an amalgamation of, like, a lot of lovely young boys. Here, like, please forgive me again for reading another quote from her, but she said, like, basically she was tired of how rockers were depicted in books and film and television as, like, dumb oafs. And she said he reminded her of all the clever, self-taught, whimsical, hilarious boys you could just while away the afternoon in a pub with, smoking and drinking and shooting the breeze about anything. So I made John Kite out of all those lovely boys. He's basically Richard Burton in a furred coat singing the songs of American Music Club. I know exactly how all his songs sound. So, like, this creation, but the important thing about it, he's larger than life. He's, like, flamboyant. That Richard Burton analogy is very interesting. He's larger than life. He's flamboyant. He's very loquacious. And that is not what I think of when I think of Alfie Allen, who's, like, such a closed off, like, not closed off, but closed in interior actor, you know, not just as Theon, but in, like, I don't know, I'm even thinking about him in, like, John Wick, where he plays this, like, awful gangster kid. Like, you know, he's, but I would love to see him nail this. I would love this for him. This would be fantastic.
Well, he has this, like, nerdiness. Like, this, I feel like you need to have someone in this role who's not, like, the automatic alpha rock star character. Like, you can't have, like, a Mick Jagger type. He has to be kind of vulnerable and sweet and someone who, like, you meet the rock star and you're like, oh, well, you're kind of, like, you would connect to him as a 17-year-old who doesn't necessarily feel comfortable in her own skin. And that's what made me kind of excited about it. Like, see him as kind of this, like, slightly uncommon kind of love interest who you can definitely see appealing to a 17-year-old girl who's still figuring everything out.
Yeah, and we should say he's not the only, there's also a figure in the book who I believe, I can't get full confirmation on, but I believe is being played by Stephen Delane, or Frank Delane, who's Stephen Delane's son, who was on Fear of the Walking Dead and stuff like that. So, you know, he's...
Yeah, he's I assume he's Tony Rich. Tony Rich. My bad cousin. He's like the, like, posh music critic who... So, I mean, a thrust of the later part of the book is that she, like, you know, she takes on this alter ego of Dolly Wilde. She's trying to be, like, she's pretending to be the wild girl until she, like, figures out who she wants to be. And then she has a lot of casual sex with a lot of people. And a lot of the book is about her kind of realizing what she does want and, like, if she wants that to be part of her life. And I think it does a really good job of not being, like, sex shaming, but also, you know, telling young women, as you're saying, is really important to Caitlin Moran, like, know what you want, go after what you actually want. Do you think a movie can capture as much of that? I wonder how it would play on screen, and I feel like they're going to have to tweak that somehow.
You and I were sort of messaging back and forth about, like, well, you know, whether or not it could translate, that aspect specifically, I think, could translate. And the reference movie that I brought up as, like, what I hope it hits is Diary of a Teenage Girl, which is a similar sort of sexual exploits of a young woman who, in, like, certain contexts, it could be seen as, like, her just making bad life choices and, like, shaming. And ultimately, it's not. It's very, like, freeing and empowering for her. And I think you're right that this book tries to walk an even trickier line, which is, like, there's no shame in it. Like, when she makes a resolution to sort of, like, do different things with her life, she does not take tons and tons of sex off the menu for herself.
Or tons of drinking, which that was the other part where I was like, girl, you gotta slow it down.
She's drinking Mad Dog, which is so disgusting. But anyway, you know, so it's not like, oh, all that sex I was having was the mistake. The mistake is that she was framing, I just thought it was so kind of profound the way that this character, you know, who is like an overweight, awkward teen is framing sex as like, I'm enjoying this purely because I am making someone else's night better.
That
is such a relatable thing to, like, especially like young women first figuring out sex, or like or maybe, you know, beyond being young. I think that is a thing that we are taught as women, and to see it sort of depicted that way for in so many different encounters, it's just like, I found it really, like, shockingly insightful. So I don't know how that can be translated without that internal monologue running through it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. Like, it gets into such complicated issues about, like, consent being complex, and that's the thing that's really hard to show. So it does make me wonder if we're going to get some kind of voiceover. Does Diary of a Teenage Girl have voiceover? I feel like it does.
I think it might. It definitely has those, like, weird, those interesting, like, fantasy artistic sequences sort of thing. You know what I mean?
And speaking of fantasy, there is someone who's credited on IMDb as playing Emily Bronte. So I don't know where this film might be going with that.
That's interesting. And there's also, as you note, there's roles for Emma Thompson and Jameela Jamil that I don't really see where those characters fit into the book that we're given. So I don't know if we're getting, like, a tremendously different book film from the book.
Me wonder if they're going to be in the music industry somehow, because when she's working for this magazine that's all men. And I think it's accurate to make it all men and kind of important, but I can imagine there being some, like, older female, because there's not really women that she looks up to in the book. Like, she's kind of modeling a teenage girl's sense of what a grown-up woman would be, and that's part of the process of her learning how to be herself. But right. I can imagine, like, if you have an Emma Thompson in your life and you're 17, how much better do you turn out than you could otherwise?
Exactly. It'll be interesting. I kind of like that she's the only woman at this, and so she has to figure it all out for herself.
Yeah.
But, I'll be interested to see what happens. There's a technique she uses that might be interested to see visualized. And I think it goes away in the back half of the book, but where she'll reference a book and then she'll, like, name the book and the publisher and the publishing date.
Yeah.
You know? And so I don't know if, like, maybe those little references will become sort of externalized authorial figures or something like that, because she's she's a voracious reader and a voracious consumer of like film and TV, and that's a fun thing. I don't know, like, how alienating it is for you, Katie, who is less obsessive than me about British culture, but mm-hmm. there's a lot of British TV and film references in there. You know, she's a culture critic for the Times, so it's
a lot of me being like, I'm aware that Blackadder exists, so I'm just gonna go with you saying that this is a relevant thing. It's also a lot of, like, indie pop of the early 90s that I'm, like, not, you know, like, the fact that she, like, goes and sees the Smashing Pumpkins at, like, a tiny club in northern England. I was like, oh yeah, okay, I get the timeline on that. But then there's a lot of other stuff where I'm like, sure, okay, that was a thing.
The other thing that I want to say is that it's interesting the way that it deals with the life of the critic and criticism. And this is something that I don't consider myself a film critic, but, like, you know, a lot of our friends are film critics, and, like, the depiction of the critic on screen, mm-hmm. and, like, how they're often vilified because the people writing about them or making them are screenwriters or directors who have had their feelings hurt by criticism. And so the best example, or the most iconic example, I think, that people hold up is this character in Birdman, who, like, is just this awful critic who talks about, you know, basically the joys of eviscerating something. And I thought this book does a really good job of engaging with that conversation, but because it's written by a former and current critic, she's more a columnist and a profiler than she's a critic these days, but, like, you know, she's still a critic. And just, but that idea of, like, how it's harder to write about something you love than score easy hits off something you hate. And engaging in that, I think is really thoughtfully done in the book. I don't know how it will come across on screen, but I thought that was, like, a thoughtful entry into this conversation where it's not just, like, critics are evil and they just like bashing things. She's like, yeah, there is power in just tearing everything down. And this is very Jo March of her. Is this ultimately what I want to be writing? Mm-hmm. You know, is this what I want to be doing? Yes, although, the money's nice, but, you know.
I have to bring out my editor side, that there. She has this editor figure, Kenny, who I feel like is kind of an underdeveloped character and might be interesting in the movie. But she writes her profile of John Kite that she's been assigned. That's how she meets him. And it's, like, just basically gushing all over him. And they publish it seemingly without edits and kind of call her out within the story for being like, okay, here you go. You're sounding kind of like a fan. And like just edit her story, man. Like, don't sell her out in that way. You're not doing your job if you're letting someone publish something and, like, embarrassing themselves. So she deserved better from her editors.
I love that. You're like, justice for editorial representation.
Thank you. Anything showing good editors is always on my side. So maybe the movie can pick that up. But also, it's kind of important to the plot that, like, she be allowed to kind of fall on her ass in that way. So maybe it has to happen.
Callum Warren's a much more famous figure in the UK than she is here.
Yeah.
She has this column in the Times. She created a TV series based on her book called Raised by Wolves about growing up impoverished in Wolverhampton and stuff like that. But I first learned about her actually in this profile she wrote of Benedict Cumberbatch, which is this very famous. She famously described him as lavishly, wonkily beautiful, 900 feet tall, has a voice like a jaguar hiding in a cello. That's
she's such a good writer.
I know. Voice like a jaguar hiding in a cello. Tumblr loved that description, obviously, of Benedict Cumberbatch. And it came at the beginning of his, Sherlock mania is when she wrote this profile. And I've always admired that she perfectly captured that. And she has a bunch of those one-liners. Something I could tell in this book is, I'm pretty sure she probably lifted some of her own adolescent writing and put it in there. Mm-hmm. But also can you just kind of see her being this was really funny, this observation I made, so I'm going to put it in the book. You know what I mean? There's just these bunch of sort of self-satisfied witticisms, but deservedly self-satisfied, you know what I mean? Because they are very funny. So
yeah, well, that's something that I wonder too about the movie is so many of those lines are what makes the movie so satisfying. And I think the story is good. The Johanna is such a great character, but the moral of the story is kind of be true to yourself, and the revelation she gets to are not especially surprising. You feel kind of the comfortable rhythms of the story. So I do wonder again, if you have more of her voice stripped out of it, just because it's about people and you're not going to have her kind of narrating the entire experience, I wonder if the movie can kind of stand upon its own without that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, these are the challenges of adaptation. I think this is something we're going to revisit, in our last two books that we talk about, where it's just sort of you can have the best book in the world, which maybe Little Women is, maybe this isn't. I think even Catelyn Warren might agree with that. But you can have fantastic books and the adaptation process is still so tricky. Mm-hmm. And it's my favorite thing to think about and talk about. I mean, I am probably most well known for talking about Game of Thrones, and the reason I'm interested in Game of Thrones is it's an adaptation. And so what you keep and what you leave out is so telling in terms of what you think the story is versus what I, the reader, think the story is,
Yeah.
And so if this becomes, I mean, we don't have a trailer yet. All we have out there in the world for this film is the cast list, a shot of Beanie Feldstein looking
awkward in bad glasses.
She looks like, what is it? Like Mary Margaret, the superstar Catholic girl.
Oh, Mary Catherine Gallagher?
Yeah, Mary Catherine Gallagher. That's exactly what she looks like. And then there's a photo of Alfie Allen in a fur coat. And that's all we have. We don't have a trailer or anything. So I don't know what tone they're going for. If this is going to be an out-and-out comedy, I'm so fascinated to see what they do with it. So, but as you said up top, we don't know when this is going to hit in the U.S., but it is such a great summer read.
It's such an easy read. You can blow through it so fast. It's really funny. It makes you want to read all of her other columns. So it's recommending the book wholeheartedly while wondering what the movie's going to be like.
Yeah. The last thing I want to mention, you have sort of a references in your notes as well. My copy, which I bought in 2014, the hardcover, has a pull quote from Lena Dunham on the front in this little pink dot. And I think it came out around the same time that Lena Dunham's book came out, or thereabouts. And all subsequent editions have a different...
The one I have has a people quote on the front.
Yep, that little pink dot that has a Lena Dunham quote on my cover. So I feel like the people, the tide shifted on Lena Dunham, and they're like, let's pull that quote off the cover.
It tells you that the environment has changed in the 5 years since this was published, but it does not make the book any less relevant.
Yeah, I think she's fared better than some, she's compared to Amy Schumer or Chelsea Handler or Lena Dunham, a lot of women who have sort of, I don't want to say crash and burn, that's not quite right, but just sort of...
had very bright moments in the spotlight and then kind of inevitably have to retreat from that.
There you go. So read this book. That's all I want to say. Read this book.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess that wraps us on How to Build a Girl. Next week, we're going to be talking about The Last Thing He Wanted by Joan Didion, who's another extremely prominent female writer, a very different book, which will be fun to get into. So come back and join us for the book club edition of that.
Yes, the last thing, sorry, I just do need to shoehorn this in. The last thing I want to say about this book is that obviously it has echoes of my favorite film of all time, which is Almost Famous. So if you're an Almost Famous fan, and you want another story of a teen rock critic a little over their head and try to figure out the line between fandom and criticism and all of that, this is a story for you.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gecs, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Okay, Mike, so let's now go to your interview with Ben Stiller. He came in studio and talked to you. You guys got into some really interesting deep dives about his own history in television and filmmaking. What stood out to you about this conversation?
Well, as you know, he directed Escape at Dannemora. He didn't create it. He was hired by the showrunners to direct. And he did a really incredible job. And it's a very different kind of a thing for someone that we obviously all associate with comedy. Ben Stiller's directed a lot of comedies, including, you know, Zoolander and Beyond and Tropic Thunder. But here he's in a much like darker tone. And so it was a cool, interesting choice on the part of the showrunners. He did an incredible job with it. He talked pretty candidly about, you know, the joy and pain of working with really talented actors who have strong ideas about what they're doing. So it's a really fun conversation. We talked about his long history in TV going back all the way to guest spots on, you know, Kate and Ally and Miami Vice.
I love that his character on Miami Vice was Fast Eddie Felcher. Like, what a name. What a Miami Vicey name.
Which he remembered off the top of his head, by the way.
He did.
And I just think, you know, one thing that was fun is after the conversation, he was like, man, he had just come from Good Morning America, where, you know, I think you get 90 seconds to talk before they make, you know, like a batch of brownies or something. And so he was really excited to kind of spend some time talking seriously about his work and his career. And I said to him, you know, one of the great things about this podcast, just to shout out our listeners a little bit, is that, you know, our listeners actually care about this stuff. They care about movies. They care about television. They care about awards. They're passionate about all this. So it was just a nice reminder of how lucky we are all to do this. And at the very end, I said, oh, I forgot to ask you one question, which is, don't you think that Donald Trump is doing blue steel all the time with his weird, like, purse lips? And he said, you know, he's obsessed with that movie. He was in the movie, which I had forgotten. And then just as he got on the elevator, he said, and yes, he is doing Blue Steel. So that you will not hear that in the interview, but that was maybe my favorite part. But anyway, the rest of it was pretty good, too.
Let's take a listen to it now.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here in the studio with Ben Stiller, the director of Escape at Dannemora, which has 12 Emmy nominations. Am I right about this? Did we count?
I believe
correctly?
So, yes.
Yeah. I love the show. Patricia Arquette has already won the SAG Award, the Golden Globe, for her role. You have already won the DGA Award for your directing. So congratulations already.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it's been a really great experience doing it and having people enjoy watching it. And, you know, it's always nice.
And you've done TV over the years. You won an Emmy in 1993, I believe, for writing The Ben Stiller Show.
It's been a long time.
Yeah. And also, I don't want to... It's so interesting looking at your IMDb page, which is incredibly impressive in many things, but there's also some amazing gems on there.
Especially, I'm sure.
Well, you were on Kate and Ally. You were on Miami Vice. So yeah. It's a return to a very different kind of TV. Is that fair to say from those days?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, those were all great experiences when I was starting out. And I do have great memories of those jobs because so exciting to get a job and to, right, you know, have a chance to be in, you know, Miami Vice. I had one scene in it, but it was, you know, like the biggest show on TV.
What was your character? Do you remember?
I was Fast Eddie Felcher, who, uh-huh, was an informant. I sold religious goods, and it was an episode starring Brian Dennehy. And,
oh, wow,
Croc and Tubbs came and interrogated me and tried to get some information. And
pushed you around
down
a little bit? Or,
yeah, and yeah, I got my ear pierced for the role because I was such a dedicated actor.
That's amazing. That's great. No clip-ons here, you know.
No. Full it was ear all, piercing. Yeah.
As far as I know, you have an incredible directing career, you know, especially in film, everything from, you know, Reality Bites to Zoolander, Tropic Thunder, Secret Life of Walter Mitty. But you've acted in pretty much everything you've directed. Is this the first time you haven't acted as you directed?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I directed Cable Guy, the Cable Guy with Jim Carrey, 20 something years ago, and I had one scene, a couple scenes.
Did like a Hitchcock style.
Yeah, but this is really the first time I've done that. It's something I've always intended to do, but it finally happened. And so now that it's finally happened, it's kind of almost strange to me that this is the first time I'm actually doing it. Because in my head, I feel like, well, this is what something I've wanted to do and feels very natural in terms of, you know, what I enjoy doing.
Yeah.
I really do enjoy directing and acting, but this one, the experience was, it really was kind of a revelation for me personally, how much I enjoyed not doing both at the same time.
I think there is this sort of ongoing interesting question about film and TV and how different are they now? Are they different at all? Obviously, there's a structural difference if you're making a limited series versus one, you know, 90-minute to 2.5-minute arc. But in terms of the production, is it basically, is a show like this basically at film levels in terms of the budgets and the, you know, everything that you can call on? Or are you doing different TV things that are different from when you're making a movie?
Well, I mean, the reality is the budget is not as big as it would be for maybe for a movie that, you know, might do all this just as a feature. But also the reality is that these days movies aren't being made about this kind of subject matter at this level. So actually the budget's probably bigger than what you would get. It's probably, you know, maybe 30 years ago you could have a decent budget for a story like this.
Right.
But these days it would be much harder. So it's really, it is the place where you can do it on the level that that it deserves. I love movies. My desire is always to see something up on a big screen. When we had our premiere, we were able to show the first episode at Lincoln Center, and it was so exciting to see it up there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But then there's something else you get with television, which is the intimacy that the viewer has with it and the accessibility and the connection that grows from week to week with it that I experienced that I'd never really experienced before. I'm not a huge fan of social media, but that's one of the things I think that's really good about it, is that you can feel this connection with the audience on something that's coming out on a weekly basis. So
yeah. So let's talk about this incredible cast, and really not surprising that you guys got nominated for an Emmy for casting with this group. And you and Patricia Arquette, you guys go back a ways, right?
Yeah. We worked on Flirting with Disaster with David O. Russell.
Amazing film. One of my faves.
Yeah. It was a really fun movie, crazy movie to do together. And that was a long time ago. And I'd worked with Patricia and, you know, we'd stayed in touch over the years, but, you know, hadn't really seen each other that much. And we both had the same manager, Molly Madden, starting out, and she's just a great person. So I've always stayed in touch with her. And when we were thinking about who would play Tilly, Patricia was really the first person we thought of because, you know, she just, you know, she's such a unique and wonderful actress.
Yeah. Well, and something that's so interesting about the story and about the character is it's a story about something you don't see, you know, often, and certainly in this context, it's the destructive, in some ways, power of a middle-aged woman's sexuality and a woman who's not really vain in a lot of the kind of ways that you know, when you see a sexualized woman on screen, that's not what she looks like. But she's very, you know, she has desires and, you know, they have real consequences. So what was that? Was that a conversation that you guys had? I mean, you know, how did you guys work together to kind of construct this role and the performance?
That is definitely something we talked about. When you look at the character, you don't think of her as being this person whose sexuality is what she leads with. But the reality was in that environment of her being the civilian supervisor in this tailor shop. So there's 40 male inmates that she's overseeing at sewing machines with just one corrections officer in the room and a back room that they can go into. She was definitely, you know, using that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of what the story is about manipulation, both how the prisoners were manipulating her and also I think how she felt she was manipulating them in terms of what she wanted.
Yeah.
And her sexuality was part of that. And, yeah, it's definitely something you don't see a lot in movies or television, a woman of that age who's not necessarily, you know, has this, like, quote-unquote sexy figure. She's, mm-hmm. you know, looks like a real person who's and that was important for Patricia to really embrace that, which I think, you know, that's what's one of the amazing things about her as both a person and an actor is that she's willing to just do what it takes to portray the character in the most realistic way.
And then I'm fascinated by this, by the relationship between, you know, the characters portrayed by Paul Dano and Benicio. And I'm wondering, what was their relationship like on set? Because it's a, you know, they're sort of partners in crime, literally. But also, you know, Paul Dano is very wary of Benicio's character, you know, has real concerns about how he's operating. But Benicio's kind of in charge. I mean, it's a fascinating dynamic. And I'm curious, like, what was their working relationship like? Obviously, they're both pros, but I'm curious how it manifested.
Yeah, it was very interesting because they're very, very different actors.
Yeah.
And I think the way they approach the work is very different. And they didn't really know each other before. And, you know, the relationship between these two guys in real life, the characters in the story, was that they met in the cell block. They didn't know each other beforehand. And really the way that they came together was, I think they both had this mutual desire to escape. Mm-hmm. So that was really the one thing that connected them. So they didn't have a lot else in common. And David Sweat, who is Paul's character, had killed a policeman sort of impulsively. Richard Madd had killed a couple of people and was more of a, what you would call a cold-blooded killer.
Mm-hmm.
Inside the prison, he was very well-connected and very comfortable in that prison environment. David Sweat was not. He felt he always was a target because he had killed a police officer, both from corrections officer and also other inmates. He was kind of skinny, so he was always trying to build up his muscle and trying to be tougher than he was. So, you know, I think both Paul and Benicio got into the background of their characters and came at it with their own personal ideas, and then, you know, and then you just kind of put people together, and they're both obviously professionals,
mm-hmm.
But they kind of had to figure their way around each other, and mm-hmm. I think that contributed to the relationship on screen,
yeah,
because they were both trying to figure each other out,
mm-hmm.
and they also had to spend about 7 months together,
right.
In tight quarters,
mm-hmm.
And when you're figuring out a scene, you know, each actor is going to come with their own point of view. And both of them are very, you know, specific and thoughtful actors who will break down a scene. And so there can be a lot of discussion about it. And, you know, for me, I'm there trying to just sort of figure out, okay, I know what I see the scene as. Benicio has his idea of what he thinks the scene is. Paul has his idea. Usually mm-hmm. actors, being an actor myself, I know you come from the point of view of, like, you see the scene from your character's point of view.
Sure. Yeah,
which is your job, you know, that's what you should do. And so it's sometimes it was sort of like going, okay, well, you see it that way and he sees it this way.
Yeah,
I kind of see it this way.
Right.
And let's see what happens. So, you know, that's part of the process. And, you know, every scene was different that way. So sometimes we'd kind of all be on the same page, and other times, you know, Benicio would have an idea and Paul was trying to reconcile it, or vice versa. And I think that tension, which is creative tension, not personal tension, is what, you know, just that feeds everything.
Yeah, you can see there's like an electricity on the screen there. Do you end up shooting multiple? Do you kind of say like, we'll try it your way, and then we'll try it his way, and then we'll try it my way?
It depends, you know. I think it's from scene to scene. You know, I don't like to. Yeah, if there's an idea that, you know, an actor says, "Hey, can we try another one?" Mm-hmm. I'm an actor, so I always want to be sensitive to that. And so, you know, it's the only thing that can ever stop you from that. Sometimes is a schedule, you know, taking too much time. But really, you want an actor to walk away from a scene feeling like they explored everything they wanted to explore. And you know, sometimes there were a couple of times when Benicio or Paul would have an idea and say, "This is how I see it," and then I'd say, "Well, maybe let's try it this way." And they go, "I don't know. I'm pretty married to that." And then, and then it's like, "Well, do you want to consider a separation or maybe a divorce?" you know, again, that's part of the process.
That kind of brings me naturally to a thing I'm dying to ask you about, which is the don't tell anybody moment.
Well, that's one of those, for sure.
Which is one of the greatest things, but it's an insane line reading. I mean, it's fantastic.
It
he just says, "Don't tell anybody," and holds it to Patricia for like rather a long time. And you do an incredible cutaway to her face. Like,
right.
What the hell was that?
Right.
But can you tell us about that and how it came about?
Yeah. So, I mean, most of these scenes came about from real events that happened that we would either piece together from interviews that Tilly or David Sweat did with the police, or, you know, eyewitness accounts of what happened. But a lot of that stuff that happened in the back room, you know, nobody knows what really happened.
Mm-hmm.
So we just have to go off of like as much of the sort of circumstantial evidence of what went on. But we really don't know what was said back there unless Tilly said, "This is what he said to me." You know, or David Sweat says, "I said this." And a lot of times, you don't know if they're telling the truth.
Right.
But we felt it was important to establish the idea that, you know, that he was telling her that they were going to escape. You know, in that scene, he basically says it's going to be years until they get out, because that's what they thought it was going to be, because they were just chopping, they were hammering away at this wall. And then she sort of dismisses it. And Benicio, I think, felt it was really important. So we came up with the idea of this line of him saying, "Just don't tell anybody,"
mm-hmm.
because he's a little bit concerned that she's not taking it seriously, and all of a sudden they're vulnerable. And I think he felt it was important to scare her.
Right.
And, you know, he came in with that line reading, and it definitely was scary. And yeah, that was one where Benicio was married to it. And as a director, I was like, you know, how much of a stand do I want to take here?
Right.
And, you know, have the option of doing it a different way. And, you know, that one, you know, Benicio stayed married to it.
Yeah, so yeah, yeah. Didn't have an option.
And, you know, sometimes I can be like, to be honest, I can be like an ego thing as a director. They go, "Well, I have to be able to show him that, you know, I want it this way."
Yeah.
But I also, you know, if that comes up once or twice during a shoot, during a 7-month shoot, if you have a mutual respect with each other, then it's not a big deal. And
yeah,
I also appreciated his instinct on it. And
yeah,
for me, when I saw it, originally that was not the last scene of the episode. There was a scene where they're down in the tunnel, and this episode was supposed to end with them down in the tunnel after that. But when I saw it, it was such a huge moment. And for me, I immediately went to Patricia's reaction because it was so weird. And I was like, okay, well, to me, this as crazy as that line reading is, this moment is really about Patricia's reaction to it, because that's what he's trying to do, is scare the hell out of her.
Yeah.
So, and for the first time, she realizes that she's in much deeper than she had ever imagined.
Yeah.
So I ended up putting the scene, when I saw it, at the end of the episode and, you know, and ending on Patricia. And that, to me, it actually ended up, you know, for me, it was, you know, one of the more important scenes in the show because of that.
Yeah, yeah. So let me ask you about comedy and drama. Obviously, you are one of the, you know, comedy greats of our time. There's a cliche that it's easier for comedy people to go to drama than the other way around, because comedy is so technical it's so kind of hard to get people to laugh, and that drama is something that's a little less technical. Do you think that that's true? Do you think that, do you see yourself doing more drama in the future?
I think comedy is, it's a thing where, you know, you have a sense of humor. I think you either have a sense of humor or you don't. It doesn't mean you're necessarily funny or you're not, but like in terms of being an actor, you can sense where something could be funny. I've had the experience with dramatic actors who have been really, really good at comedy, and also dramatic actors who are not great at comedy. Mm-hmm. And I find it's because sometimes they think, oh, well, to be funny, I have to do it a certain way or I have to do a certain thing. And I think my feeling of comedy is you're never trying to be funny. You're just trying to be real in a funny situation. Mm-hmm. And if the situation is funny, then the humor will come out of it and you can't try to make it funny.
Mm-hmm.
I do enjoy doing drama because there's less of an expectation from the audience to laugh, because
right.
that's what
yeah.
Now it's wonderful to make an audience laugh and to be in a theater and, you know, have that experience of, you know, is to be, and to be a part of it. If you're doing something on screen that's making people laugh, there's is like no better feeling.
But I think Steve Coogan told me that, you know, he'll screen a comedy film and like you stand in the back during the screening, and if you're not getting whatever it is, 2.3 laughs per minute, like you got to go back and recut it, right?
Yes.
I mean, it does get kind of technical.
Yeah, I mean, every movie that I have ever directed has gone through the test screening process. This Escape at Dannemora is the first thing I ever directed that didn't go through any test screenings.
Yeah.
And the test screening process can be painful, especially with studio movies, because they have a certain criteria of literally a number score that they feel the movie has to get, and right. that's what they base their marketing and the amount of money they're going to spend on it and the number of screens they're going to put out. So there's a lot of pressure on that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's movies should never be graded like a test.
Mm-hmm.
But what it is helpful for is to put it in front of an audience and see where they're laughing and where they're not laughing. And you know, if you're making a comedy, you want people to be laughing. And, I mean, Coogan, you know, he did Stan and Ollie, that
yes.
movie, and he was so
yeah.
good in that. And I think Stan Laurel was known for going in the back of the theater and re-editing, you know, his comedies based on the timing of the laughs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that might be how I'm slightly mangling, but
well,
yes.
Yeah, but Coogan mm-hmm. is brilliant. I mean, he's yeah. one of the funniest people ever, and he is a technician in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your responsibility when you're making a comedy, is to do that, because that's how you want it to work.
Yeah.
You want the audience to have that rhythm and to feel things build and to have, you know, the laughs be as big as they can be. And, you know, just almost like, you know, it's like a piece of music. You want it to work that way.
And you grew up, that's your family, right? I mean, your
yes.
parents were are legendary comedians, right?
Yeah.
Jerry and Ann Mira.
Yeah.
Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira. By the way, your dad, I interviewed him for a comedy issue of Vanity Fair maybe 15 years ago. And he's the only person in my entire career who sent me a written thank you note afterwards. And I felt I needed to tell you that.
That's, yes, one of the kindest people ever.
Yeah,
One of the funniest people ever. I mean, you know, that was part of, yeah, growing up and watching my parents work at that, that's definitely, you know, that was the goal. Though it was always, I think, through, you know, there's always a grounded human element that you want to be a part of that. I think that actually makes things funnier when people can relate to it and feel like it's something that's real.
Yeah.
But the great thing about drama is it's very subjective, and it's, you know, you can say, I think this is working, and that's it, you know.
Yeah.
And if nobody's going to dispute that, you know, they can say, oh, well, I don't, or I thought that was indulgent. But really, it's a freedom where you go, this is what feels right to me.
Yeah.
And I experienced that on this and in the editing of this, and it was kind of a, you know, it was a strange experience at first, I have to say, because I realized I had never done this before. I'd never, not directed a drama, which I hadn't really, but I guess I hadn't done that, but the experience of not having to put it through that process.
Right.
So
yeah.
It would really be more about sitting with it alone or sitting with the editors and going, okay, this, you know, that feels right. I don't know. Is that too long? Is that not too long? I don't know, but it really feels right to me. And maybe showing it to a few friends or showing it to some people in the office and, you know, getting some feedback. But then that's it.
You know? You got to trust yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
That does it for this week's episode. Please find us at vanityfair.com, where you can find a transcript of the Ben Stiller interview and all kinds of other stuff. You can also find us on Twitter at Little Gold Men, and on our own, I'm at Katie Rich, and Mike.
Mike_Hogan.
And Joanna.
Joe wrote this.
This episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best description of what Richard is up to on his vacation goes to Ben Stiller via Mike.
He is doing Blue Steel.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
From PR.